It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy because there might just be something you want to write down, some information you want to perpetuate in time that your little brain cells might not remember after a while. Anyway, let's start with our forestry update for December 2013. Wishing happy holidays and a happy new year to all. And forestry update is prepared every month by Jody Frediani, forestry consultant to the Loma Prieta chapter of the Sierra Club and director of Central Coast Forest Watch. And Jody wants to let us know about a new timber harvest plan here locally, 1-13-123 SCRSMO, which means Santa Cruz and San Mateo County. The owner is Red Tree Properties and Roger Evans. The size of the timber harvest plan is 658 acres. That's a pretty big one for around here. It's located on Pescadero Creek and Little Boulder Creek are adjacent to and flow through the plan area. So we've got some interesting stuff there. And this is located in the Waterman Gap area. Matt Bissell is the registered professional forester. The following are some of the issues that have been raised during the first review of this timber harvest plan. The winter operating plan is incomplete and unclear. The cumulative impacts assessment is incomplete. There are problems with mapping legibility. The lack of discussion in regards to oil production lines in the plant area that could possibly be impacted by heavy equipment. The use of annual ryegrass for erosion control, even though it is considered a persistent and invasive grass by the California Exotic Pest Plant Council. And there are no identified measures to be taken to deal with existing pampas grass and French broom in the plant area. And we want to thank Jody Frediani for letting us know about this timber harvest plan. If you have questions, contact the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. And they have a website where you can look at this entire timber harvest plan. News from the grand jury resistance back east. Not nothing. A new statement from grand jury resister Jerry Koch in this story from Jerry Resist's website. Via the Earth First Newswire. Very soon, Judge Keenan will decide whether to order my release or to continue my incarceration. He will make this decision based in large part on my claim that what began as coercive confinement has clearly become punitive, meaning that there never was any chance that incarceration would intimidate me into cooperating with this grand jury, and that after serving 7 months in this place, my resolve has only grown stronger. That is not to say that I haven't suffered. I've lost more during my incarceration than I ever thought possible. I grieve for every goodbye, and I doubt that some of these scars will ever heal. It is during truly difficult times that reveal what lives in the core of people, and that knowledge can sometimes be incredibly painful. But so too can that knowledge make us stronger. I take comfort from those of my fellows who have also refused to be made into subjects of this place. My own resistance is far from unique. It is found in those who have always said no to those in power. My refusal to cooperate is my contribution to this tradition of defiance to arbitrary and repressive power. I will not cooperate. I will not be institutionalized. No compromise in this. I will not sacrifice my dignity in order to leave this place, and that's not nothing. I offer my belated but heartfelt condolences to the family and partner of Herman Wallace. Please take a moment to write to Albert Woodfox, the last member of the Angola 3 still in prison. And please take a moment to participate in the Move Marie campaign at supportmariemason.org. With love, with dignity, and solidarity for anarchy, Jerry Koch. A well-loved New York anarchist, Jerry Koch, 24, is not charged with a crime, but was taken into federal custody for refusing to testify in front of a grand jury, those black boxes of federal prosecutorial system, with a grim history of harassing activists. As far as his lawyers have gleaned, Jerry was never the target of the grand jury investigation, which, based on political ethics, he has twice refused to cooperate. For his silence, or as the justice system put it, contempt, he faces prison time of up to 18 months, the time limit for a given grand jury before charges must either be brought or the investigation dropped. Over the course of nearly two grand jury sittings believed to relate to the same incident, the setting off of an incendiary device outside a Times Square military recruiting station, in which no one was injured, Jerry has made amply clear that he has nothing to say to prosecutors. As such, with ample evidence that he will never testify, Jerry's imprisonment can be seen as little more than punitive. This, despite the fact that the 24-year-old has been charged with no crimes under U.S. law. Jerry's silent resistance continues from within the same Manhattan federal prison holding hacktivist Jeremy Hammond. Jerry was taken into custody as a large crowd of New York activists and anarchists packed Hammond's contempt hearing in support for him. This political silence, a manifestation of his antipathy to state intimidation, is the best example of meaning what you say. Earlier this year, two anarchists from the Pacific Northwest who had been held in federal prison for 5 months for their grand jury resistance were freed by a judge who ruled that both Mrs. Olenchik and Mr. Duran have proved extensive declarations explaining that although they wish to end their confinement, they will never end their confinement by testifying. The court finds their declarations persuasive. And a Sacramento family faces felony charges for selling sport-caught fish. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife officers arrested a Sacramento family of three early Saturday morning for illegally selling sport-caught fish from the Delta. Luan Van Dow, 51, his wife Meng Ti Bui, 49, and their son Tuan An Dao, 29, were arrested by CFW officers after more than a month of watching the family fish daily in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and then hide their fish in a hidden compartment aboard their boat. The suspects also appeared to have an established network of buyers to whom they would sell fish on a regular basis. In California, commercial fishermen are permitted to sell their catch directly to restaurants, but private or sport fishing catch is illegal to resell. Luan Vandel and Meng Ti Bui were convicted of poaching fish in 2006. During the current investigation, Tuan An Dao was cited for possession of an oversized sturgeon on November 16th. Convicted poachers who continue to sell California's fish and wildlife for personal profit are a wildlife officer's highest priority, said CDFW Law Enforcement Division Captain Rudy Aruda. These poachers are taking away from the legal and legitimate anglers. All three suspects face charges of felony conspiracy and illegal sale of sport-caught fish. If convicted, these suspects could face jail time, significant fines, loss of their fishing licenses, and other penalties. Charges will be filed with the Yolo County District Attorney when the investigation is complete. And I can't believe that they have fishing licenses after being previously convicted of poaching. I don't know what's going on here. Anyway, if you need more information, go to www.dfg.ca.gov, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And a Chinese citizen has pleaded guilty to rhino horn smuggling in New Jersey. In this story reported by Elizabeth Diltz, editing by Scott Malone and Gunnar Dickinson, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A Chinese citizen, the admitted ringleader of an international smuggling operation that trafficked in $4.5 million of rhinoceros horns, ivory cups, and trinkets, pleaded guilty on Thursday in federal court in New Jersey, prosecutors said. Zifai Lai, 29, said he had sold 30 raw rhino horns for as much as $17,500 each to Chinese factories that carve them into cups that are thought to improve health, according to federal prosecutors. The brutality of animal poaching wherever it occurs feeds the demand of a multi-billion dollar illegal international market, said Paul Fishman, the U.S. attorney for New Jersey, at a press conference. Zifai Lee's conviction is a warning to those who would be lured by the profits of dealing in cruelty. Among the horns sold, 13 were from black rhinos, which are critically endangered and have a population of less than 5,000, according to a statement issued by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Investigators began focusing on Lee in 2011 when a government informant sold two raw rhino horns to a middleman at the Vince Lombardi rest stop on the New Jersey stretch of Interstate 95. That middleman sold the horns to a New York City antiques dealer who worked directly for Lee, prosecutors said. The horns were wrapped in duct tape and hidden in porcelain vases. Labeled as handicrafts on custom documents, they were smuggled to Lee's connections in Hong Kong and then on to the factories in mainland China, prosecutors said. In total, Lee's New York and New Jersey connections helped him buy 25 raw rhino horns, including 13 black rhino horns, they said. Lee also bought $500,000 worth of carved ivory items from U.S. auction houses, which were not named, and several other horns and elephant tusks from connections in Texas and Florida, according to the press release. Shortly after traveling to Miami for an antiques fair, Lee texted his Queens, New York art dealer that he had $500,000 to spend on rhino horns and ivory, prosecutors said. An undercover U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent arrested Lee in a Miami hotel room where the agent sold Lee two government-supplied black rhino horns worth $59,000 each. Lee pleaded guilty to 11 counts of smuggling, illegal wildlife trafficking, and lying on customs documents. While he already forfeited $3.5 million to the Department of Justice, he could face up to 10 years in prison for each charge. And forest scientists help dispel common myths about old-growth redwood forests in this story by Betsy Herbert. When the subject is coast redwoods, people seem to come out of the woodwork to hear a talk, especially when an expert is doing the talking. On December 10th, Dr. Will Russell drew some 125 folks to hear his talk, Logging Fire and the Recovery of Old-Growth Coast Redwoods, at Cubberley Community Center in Palo Alto. The Committee for Green Foothills sponsored that event. Russell, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at San Jose State, quickly took aim at three common misconceptions about redwoods. He and his research team investigate how redwood forests naturally regenerate after logging and fire. The first myth, according to Russell, is that young, managed redwood forests sequester carbon faster than old-growth redwood forests. The audience seemed intrigued, as if they had heard this claim before. Until recently, scientists thought that old-growth redwood forests eventually just stopped growing and started slowly decaying. But a 2008 study published in the journal Nature found that old-growth forests can indeed continue to grow and accumulate carbon. Results of recent research by the Redwoods and Climate Change Initiative, sponsored by Save the Redwoods League, are even more dramatic. After measuring tree growth and carbon sequestration throughout the entire range of old-growth redwood forests, those scientists concluded ancient redwood forests store at least three times more carbon above ground than any other forests on Earth, and the rate of sequestration continues to increase with the age of the redwood trees. Russell used this recent research to shatter the myth that young forests store carbon faster than old forests. The second myth, he said, is that redwood forests need to be thin to reduce fire hazard. It's not true, Russell said, explaining that unusual characteristics of redwoods need to be considered when managing them to address fire. For example, redwoods sprout when they are cut or scarred, while most other trees used for lumber don't have this ability. When redwoods are thinned, the resulting sprouts around the cut stumps actually create fire hazard, Russell said, because the sprouts form a brushy mass that increases fuel on the forest floor. Redwoods are also unusual because of their thick bark, which makes larger redwoods extremely resistant to fire. According to Russell's documentation, the only redwood trees killed by the Lockheed and Martin fires of the last decade were less than 7.5 inches in diameter. The larger trees, though burned and fire-scarred, regenerated by sprouting along their trunks. Russell emphasized it's unwise to take a one-size-fits-all approach towards managing forests. For example, while it might be a good idea to thin pine forests in the Tahoe Basin to reduce fire hazard, pine forests are different from coast redwood forests. Pines don't sprout when cut, and they don't have fire-resistant bark. To dispel the third myth that thinning redwood forests accelerates recovery of old growth, Russell discussed his own recent research, which was inspired by his boyhood experience of observing clear-cut forests in Mendocino County. Some forest managers advocate thinning such logged-over forests to more quickly move the forest towards old growth. Russell explained that while thinning forests allows the remaining trees to grow bigger, old-growth redwood forests are very complex and more than just big trees. Russell's research analyzes how coast redwoods regenerate themselves. The research shows that different old-growth characteristics appear at different stages when forests naturally regenerate after being clear-cut. Yet, even after 100 years, some old-growth characteristics are still absent, such as the return of key native redwood understory plants. Restoration of redwood forests should focus on the soil and this understory recovery, he said. Betsy Herbert, the author, is the San Lorenzo Valley Water District's Director of Environmental Programs and serves on the Santa Cruz County Commission on the Environment and the Sempervirens Board Fund Board of Directors. And thanks to Betsy for writing up that report. PG&E has complicated the climate emergency on the Eel River in this story by Gary Graham Hughes of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The 12-month period from January to December 2013 has been the driest year on record. Watersheds across the north coast of California are feeling the stress from recent drought, the undeniable onset of local and planetary climate change, and increasing intensity of human economic activities that rely on the exploitation of scarce water resources. The hydrological conditions in the Eel River are of particular concern to the Environmental Protection Information Center, as well as many other stakeholders in the region. In response to these clearly extreme and dry conditions in the Eel River Basin, drastic reductions in flow releases from the Potter Valley Project have been requested by the Pacific Gas and Electric Company operator of the PVP, from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the agency with authority over permitting conditions for the Potter Valley Project. Earlier in December, on December 13th, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission ordered that the urgent PG&E request would be granted and that PG&E would be allowed to implement the critical water year flow releases for the Eel River below Scott Dam and into the East Fork of the Russian River through at least the end of January 2014. What this means for the Eel River is that minimum flows out of the Potter Valley Project dams, which would in a normal or dry year remain above a minimum of 100 cubic feet per second, are permitted by the federal government to drop as low as 25 cubic feet per second. Flows which will clearly present serious challenges for recovering salmonid populations in the main stem and lower sections of the Eel River. EPIC is gravely concerned about the precedent being established by this management decision. Though there are several elements of the justification for this decision that could support a temporary reduction of releases below the agreed-upon reasonable and prudent alternative of 100 cubic feet per second for this time of year, we are very concerned about the manner in which this decision was made, as well as the ramifications of a severely reduced flow regime on the health of aquatic systems in the Eel River. Foremost among EPIC concerns in regards to this decision is the manner in which public participation is being solicited after the decision has been made. As the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission states in their order granting the flow variance, i.e. severe reductions in flows, given the historical public interest in the Potter Valley Project and the associated fisheries resources, the general public should be afforded the opportunity to review and comment on a proposal of this nature. FERC goes on to explain that through the urgency of the matter, required them to approve the action even as they opened a 30-day comment period regarding the flow variance, they would be prepared to integrate public comment into future decisions about any flow deviations deemed necessary beyond January 31st, 2014. Our team at EPIC is sounding the alarm at the precedent that this process is setting as treasured North Coast rivers such as the Eel continue to come under increasing stress from the onset of the local and planetary climate emergency. It is untenable that residents of the Eel River Basin of the North Coast and of the state of California would not be consulted in a timely manner concerning such drastic changes in the management of flow regimes in the Eel River. Please take action today to request that FERC prioritize the health of the Eel River when authorizing changes in minimum flow standards, and that the public be given the opportunity to participate in a meaningful and well-informed manner prior to the decision. The threats that the dams of the Potter Valley Project present to the health of the Eel River are becoming increasingly evident as these emergency situations expose the underlying weaknesses of the aging dam infrastructure, out-of-control sedimentation in the respective reservoirs, and the archaic water management vision that is still predicated upon unsustainable water transfers from the Eel River to the Russian River. Tell FERC today that you want the public to have a meaningful voice in the management of our Eel River, and that the health of our river ecosystems must be the number one priority as our society grapples with the impacts of increasing drought and climate change. And for more information and to take action on this, go to www.wildcalifornia.org. That's www.wildcalifornia.org, and that's the website for EPIC. In a study, the State Department has ignored Keystone XL's ugly toll on America's endangered wildlife in this story by the Center for Biological Diversity, as carried on the Earth First Newswire. A new analysis by the Center for Biological Diversity finds that the State Department's review of the Keystone XL pipeline woefully underestimates the impacts it would have on some of America's most endangered species, including whooping cranes, northern swift foxes, piping plovers, pallid sturgeon, American burying beetles, and others. The study found that the State Department failed to fully consider the impacts that oil spills, power lines, habitat destruction, and construction disturbances, and expanded tar sands development in Canada will have on at least 12 endangered animals and plants. This is yet another black eye in the Keystone XL debacle. The State Department has utterly failed in its duty to fully disclose or to reduce the impacts of this pipeline on some of the rarest animals and plants in this country, said Noah Greenwald, the center's endangered species director. If this pipeline is approved, it will be a disaster for endangered species and other wildlife, unquote. Under the Endangered Species Act, the State Department must ensure the Keystone XL pipeline does not jeopardize the continued existence of any endangered species. It must disclose and mitigate any harm to endangered species before giving approval. To meet these requirements, the State Department produced a biological assessment that purported to analyze impacts to all endangered species, but concluded that only the American burying beetle would be adversely affected by the pipeline. Based on a careful analysis of other species in the path of the pipeline and their habitat needs, the center determined that, contrary to State Department's claim, that at least 11 other endangered species will be in danger from the pipeline. The State Department has tried to sweep the worst impacts of the Keystone XL under the rug, said Greenwald. Its analysis is like a shell game where spills, power lines, and other unavoidable consequences of the pipeline are hidden. Among the endangered wildlife impacts of Keystone XL, whooping cranes will be affected by toxic tailing ponds in Canada, power line collisions, and oil spills. Black-footed ferrets' habitat will be disturbed in recovery areas. Interior leased terns will have disturbance of their breeding habitat, power line collisions, and oil spills. Piping plovers will suffer power line collisions, increased exposure to predators and oil spills. Greater sage grouse will encounter oil spills near their strutting grounds and construction noise. The American burying beetle will have a loss of its vital grass habitat, smashing during construction and oil spills. Northern swift foxes construction will crush adults and offspring in their dens, and they will suffer a loss of prairie habitat. The State Department was unable to conclude most endangered species won't be harmed only by narrowing the analysis to the actual footprint of the pipeline. Of particular concern was its failure to analyze the impact of future spills on endangered species, based on the argument that such spills were unlikely to occur, an assertion that runs directly counter to other government documents predicting the pipeline could spill roughly twice a year. There was also no analysis of impacts from all the power lines and roads necessary to build and operate the pipeline. Power lines are a particular concern for endangered birds, including the whooping crane, interior least tern, and piping plover, because of the risk of collisions and because they provide perching sites for predators. Finally, the State Department didn't analyze the impact of expanded tar sands development in Alberta driven by construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, even though such development is already devastating populations of threatened woodland caribou and other wildlife and promises to be a disaster for global climate, which in turn will drive many other endangered species, including polar bears, toward extinction. And in our final story tonight, a landmark ruling deals a huge blow to a Las Vegas water grab. A Nevada judge recently rejected a controversial plan to suck massive amounts of water out of eastern Nevada and western Utah and siphon it away to feed urban sprawl in and around Las Vegas. The decision came in response to a legal challenge brought by the Center for Biological Diversity, Great Basin Water Network, and Nevada's White Pine County. For years, the Southern Nevada Water Authority has been trying to secure a water grab to suck up about 37 billion, with a B, gallons of water each year and pipe it 300 miles south to Las Vegas. A federal analysis found that 137,000 acres of wildlife habitat would be permanently destroyed by the $15 billion project, and a long list of wildlife will be affected, including 25 species of Great Basin spring snails, 14 types of desert fish, sage grouse, and Rocky Mountain elk. This is a historic ruling and a great victory for wildlife in Nevada and Utah, rural communities, and the citizens of Las Vegas, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Las Vegas-based senior scientist, Rob Marowka. And that's it for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is brought to you every week right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, please tune in tomorrow afternoon right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM or www.freakradio.org at 3 o'clock. You can also listen to the Earth First Update again on Monday nights at 9:30 on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, at their new high-power frequency of 90.3 FM. Or you can go to the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. Type in Earth First. Don't forget the exclamation point update. And download or listen to a podcast. We want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.